From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Planet of the Umps, we meet former Major League umpire Ken Kaiser. His new book is an inside look at fights on the field and tricks of the umpiring trade from his 23 years in Major League Baseball. Also, the rise and fall of a skateboarding legend. Stoked is a new documentary about skateboarder Mark Gator Rogowski. He went from international fame to a life behind bars for a brutal rape and murder. We'll talk about Gator with filmmaker Helen Stickler and former skateboarder Kenneth Park. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the highlights of the career of late American composer Jerome Maross. This month marks his 100th birthday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israel is bracing for more violence after Israeli helicopters rocketed a car in Gaza City, killing a leading Hamas figure. The Palestinian militant group says it will avenge the attack. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Jerusalem.
Following the missile strike on Ismail Abu Shanab, one of the most public faces of Hamas, the group's spiritual leader said Israel, quote, will pay the price for its crimes. Palestinian leaders said the assassination scorned the political dialogue underway up until 48 hours ago. It was then that Israel broke off all contact over the suicide bombing on a bus that killed 20 people. Israel answered with the strike in Gaza and incursions into Nablus and Jenin. A curfew was imposed on central Nablus after tanks entered the city. Ambulance workers say troops fired rubber bullets at stone throwers. But it was the Palestinians that Secretary of State Powell said need to stop violence, adding that ending the U.S.-backed roadmap is a cliff from which both sides will fall. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The U.S. military has captured the former Iraqi general known as Chemical Ali. Ali Hassan al-Majid oversaw the chemical attacks on Kurdish villages in the late 1980s, along with crackdowns on other opponents of Saddam Hussein's regime. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports from the Pentagon.
A cousin of Saddam Hussein from the dictator's home base of Tikrit, al-Majid ran branches of Iraq's intelligence service charged with rooting out so-called traitors of the regime. He earned his nickname Chemical Ali after overseeing the mustard gas and nerve agent attacks on Kurdish villages in the north, which killed thousands. He also orchestrated the bloody crackdown on Shia, who rose up after the 1991 Gulf War. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld wouldn't say how significant a catch Ali is.
Well, we won't know, will we, till we have an opportunity to visit with him.
The head of U.S. Central Command, General John Abizaid, would say only that Chemical Ali was involved in a regional way in encouraging attacks on American forces in Iraq. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, The Pentagon.
Democrats in California's congressional delegation are asking the state's voters to vote no on the recall of Governor Gray Davis, but to vote yes for Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante as a replacement candidate in case the governor is ousted. The delegation strategy runs counter to that of Davis, who had sought to keep other Democrats from running. Representative Zoe Lofgren, a Democrat from San Jose, said the delegation strongly opposes the recall, but that if California voters make a different choice, then Bustamante is the appropriate person to take over. Lofgren said the recall is a costly attempt by Republicans to reverse the results of an election that was held less than a year ago. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow gained 26 points to close at 9,423. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 17 to close at 1,777. This is NPR News. Alabama's Chief Justice told supporters today that he will not obey a federal court order to remove a monument depicting the Ten Commandments from the state judicial building. Chief Justice Roy Moore says he's very disappointed that the eight associate justices of his own court have all agreed that the monument violates the constitutional separation of church and state and must be removed. A federal grand jury in Florida has issued a murder indictment against a Cuban general and two fighter pilots involved in the 1996 shootdown of two small civilian planes. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
In June 1996, a group of Cessnas, piloted by members of a Cuban exile group called Brothers to the Rescue, were searching the Florida Straits for migrants fleeing Cuba. The group says its planes were in international airspace, while Cuban authorities say they had been warned repeatedly against crossing the country's borders. Cuban fighter jets shot down two of the planes, killing four people. The indictment, pushed by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Miami, alleges that General Ruben Martinez Puente, head of the Cuban Air Force at the time, and pilots Alberto Perez Perez and Francisco Perez Perez conspired to murder U.S. nationals. Exile groups said the indictment was long overdue and would help quell growing criticism among many Cuban Americans that the Bush administration has not been tough enough on Cuba. Though the three men could face life in prison if convicted, it's unlikely that they'll even face extradition from Cuba. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
The police chief in Charleston, West Virginia, said today that a single rifle killed all three victims in a series of sniper-style shootings at convenience stores. Chief Jerry Pauley said ballistics showed that the bullets came from the same rifle. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Aircast Foundation, working to support medicine and science through the funding of orthopedic research, on the web at aircastfoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in this week for Terry Gross. In baseball, everybody loves to yell at the umpire, and in his new book, former Major League umpire Ken Kaiser doesn't mind yelling back. Kaiser's book with author David Fisher is Planet of the Umps, a colorful collection of baseball tales revealing what gets said in those screaming arguments on the field and what umpires are thinking when everybody in the park is sure they've just blown a call. Kaiser went to umpire school at age 18 and spent a lifetime calling games, including 23 years in the big leagues. He filled out off-seasons during his minor league career working as a bar bouncer and professional wrestler. His philosophy on managers who argue would make Johnny Cochran smile. When in doubt, throw him out. Kaiser's career ended in 1999 when umpires resigned as a labor negotiating strategy. He has a pending lawsuit against Major League Baseball over severance pay and pension benefits. I asked him about one of baseball's great traditions, when a team's manager gets into the umpire's face to dispute a call. Anybody who's gone to a ball game has seen arguments and wondered, what are they saying to each other? What are managers doing? I mean, are they trying to get thrown out sometimes?
Yeah, some they'll come up. You know, I've had managers come up to me and say, "Kenny, hey, things just aren't going good here. You got to toss me tonight." And if I know the guy well, you know, I'll try and oblige him, try and help him out. They think for some reason that sets a fire underneath these players. And as far as I'm concerned, all it does is make them laugh. But you know, like Tony La Russa, I've done it with him, and there's been several umpires or several managers that I've been friends with that I'll give them the heave if they ask me to. But on the whole, when you see those guys come out there, they're not coming out there for that. They're coming out to argue.
Now, you'll let them argue a bit, right? I mean, what is it they have to do before they get tossed? Is it swearing? Is it insulting you personally?
Well, swearing is automatic. It's easy. And unless they start talking about your mother, your family heritage and stuff like that, that'll get them gone quick too. But sometimes it's just the length of the discussion. They won't let it go. They just won't leave. And There's a lot of premise for excommunication from that field, and believe me, we use them all.
Is it true you once tossed out two guys on one pitch, the first pitch of the game?
Yeah, the manager and the that was a spring training game. That was Tommy Lasorda. I had just gotten off the plane. As a matter of fact, I ran from the plane to get my rental car to the ballpark. I got there just before the national anthem. Got my gear on and ran to the field. So I get to the field, they're warming up, and the first hitter, Steve Sachs. First pitch comes in, and I call a strike. He starts yelling. I said, "What are you yelling at?" He says, "That ball's outside." I said, "We just got here. Would you mind spending a little time in this game?" He says, "Well, I'm not going to put up with this." He says, "You're right. Get out of here." So here comes Lasorda. He says, "What's going on?" I said, "I called one pitch. This guy's complaining. I ran him." I said, "Put him on the bus." I said, "Matter of fact, you go with him. You shouldn't be out here either."
So you're throwing the manager out now, too?
I've thrown out Tommy Lasorda, and I've thrown out Steve Sachs. I said, "You guys get in the bus." He says, "I'm not getting on the bus." I said, "I'll tell you what, if you don't get in the bus, we're leaving." He says, "You wouldn't do that." I said, "Why don't you try me?" They went on the bus.
there was a time when Billy Martin came out to question the call. He thought he might have been right.
Yeah, I had a play at second base, and I don't know what I did. I turned the wrong way, or I might have been thinking about a fight I had with the ex-wife, or who knows what the reason was. I called one of his players out, and he was safe from you to me. And Billy comes coming out to me, and I got, like I told you, I got along well with Bill Martin. He comes out, and he looks at me, he's got a smile on his face. He says, "Is that right?" I said, "Well, Billy, it may not be right, but that's the way it is." So he understood what I meant, and he walked away.
And Billy Martin, of course, is?
Yeah, Billy Martin was the manager of the New York Yankees.
Now, sometimes players will be jawing at an umpire from the dugout. And if you're calling from behind the plate, you got to stay pretty focused on the pitches and what's happening in the game and the count. You can't even necessarily tell who's yelling at you, can you? How do you handle that?
Oh, that's easy. You just tell the guy at first base, pick up who it is. He stands over watching them. As soon as they start yelling, he tells me, I throw him. That is something that's unacceptable. You're not going to sit there and start yelling from the dugout. You know, I'll tell you a guy who was big at that was Eddie Murray. Eddie Murray liked to yell from the dugout. I tossed him many times in my career because we pretty much hated each other. There's a word where hate come in. And I tossed him one time for never saying nothing. I tossed him from me. I stand at first base. I folded my arms. He folded his. I took a step back. He took a step back. Took a step forward. He took a step forward and started smiling. I said, I'm going to put my hands on my knees. If you put your hands on your knees, I'm throwing you out. He looks at me and smiles. I put my hand on my knees. He put his hands on my knees. I tossed him. He couldn't believe I threw him. He says, I didn't say nothing. I says, action speaks louder than words. Get out of here.
Now, these are big league ball players, and they make a lot of money. Did you ever get in trouble for, I mean, you know, people aren't coming to the ballpark to watch Ken Kaiser. They're coming to watch Eddie Murray hit.
Well, they're coming to watch a baseball game to be played professionally. They're not coming for some jock to mock people or think he's arrogant to show up. They're not coming to see me. I'm not there for them to come to see me, but I'm also there to run the game in a professional way. And once you break those rules, I always said one thing, I'm like a landlord. You're renting from me. As soon as you stop paying the rent, it's time to leave.
My guest is former Major League umpire Ken Kaiser. His book is Planet of the Umps. Let's talk about getting calls right. Working the plate in a Major League ball game has to be hard. I mean, you're back there and you look at, 300 pitches from guys that can throw a ball 90 miles an hour. Do you ever grade yourself? I mean, do you ever go back and look at tapes? I mean, when I watch ball games, there are always a few pitchers that I think, gosh, that's 8 inches outside the plate. I mean, do you ever look back at tapes and say, yeah, I missed that one?
No, I really don't. I mean, I'll tell you why, because I make so many calls during a season. I call so many pitches. You're not going to get everything right. It's just a given. I figure if I'm not going to get them right, they're going to get somebody in there that's better than me, which they didn't do for 24 years. No, I mean, I knew that I wasn't getting everything right. But I knew that they didn't have anybody that could get any more right than I could. So, hey, you're just a victim of the system. I mean, like you said, you call 300 pitches. If you get 297 of them right, who's going to do better?
Another thing we see in baseball is the bench-clearing brawl. Can you tell when that's going to happen? Can you do anything about it?
Well, you try and get to that before it's happened. I've never had a real – I had one in the minor leagues, the worst I've ever seen. But in the big leagues, I never had one where it was a darn – I stopped them before it. I used to – grab a hold of the catcher and the hitter, whoever the combatants might be, by their belts. And I was, you know, I could bench press 400 pounds when I was a kid. And I was a pretty strong guy at one time. Not that I am anymore, believe me. And I'd grab a hold of their belts, and they couldn't go anywhere. I prevented a lot of battles that way. And matter of fact, my supervisor, Marty Springsteen, kept saying to me and Bill Howe, you're going to get hurt. He's trying to stop those fights. You let them go. The theory is to let them go and let them finish it off and let them break them up. But I always use the theory that I could stop it before it started. And it worked good for me, but I wouldn't tell a young umpire to handle it that way. Haller and Springsteen were totally right.
So an umpire, when a batter drops the bat, starts to head to the mound, you're out in front of the plate holding on.
Oh, no, they're going to do a lot of they're going to do a lot of talking before that happens. They don't just strap it and run. You know, it's what'd you say? I'll kick your you know what's going to happen. And a lot of guys want to be held before it happens. I mean, they're not looking to fight. They're just putting a show on. They're acting like they're tough guys for the rest of their club, but they're not so tough. I've only met a few real, legitimate tough ball players in my life.
When you were out on the bases, did you get bored? I mean, it's not like being behind the plate where you're in on every play.
I never got bored at first and third because I usually walked over and talked to the fans. I'd go over and have a Coke with them. I'd talk to them. The people forget that the big word in this is game. Anybody know what the word game means? I know they're trying to turn it into a business, but it's still a baseball game. People like to talk to you, talk about families, where you grew up. And I would do things like that to keep it from being boring. Then there's certain situations, but that's all situation. I mean, if you're in the ninth inning and it's a 1-0 game, and you're not going to go over and start talking to the fans either. I mean, it's all situational. But you got an open game. You can talk to the people, shake hands, and put your hat on the kids. And, you know, I mean, I enjoyed that. And people like to see that when I did it.
Did you talk to players on the field?
Well, you know, you talk to them. I mean, what do you say? I mean, were you hiding your millions? I mean, a lot of them you talk to because you know them for so long.
Well, I would think you talk about the things that everybody talks about when they're watching a ball game, like, man, that was a heck of a line drive you just hit, or that was a great backhand play you made at third. You didn't.
Oh, no, never. Never. Never give them credit. It may come back and bite you. Never talk about them striking out either. No, you talked about everything but the game. You talked about the news. You talked about Iraq. You talk about other people's games, like, geez, you see what happened last night in Chicago or something like that, but you never discuss a game on the field.
Right. When you blow a call, do you ever give a team a makeup call?
You like
call?
That blow a call term, don't you? You're big on that blow a call. You never say about the ones you got right, you know?
You're like the bus driver. Every time he arrives back at the terminal safely, it's not news. It's when he has an accident that it's news.
All right, what's your question, Dave?
Are there makeup calls? You hear announcers say, well, so-and-so missed the call in the first inning, and now he's giving him a makeup call.
That is by far, and you can quote me, no matter who it is, the stupidest statement an announcer or color man or anybody in the booth could possibly make. I'm going to blame the other team for a mistake that I made, so I'm going to give it back where it might mean a ball game. How ignorant and dumb. You know, and I heard that in basketball. I've heard that in hockey. I can't even imagine those sports doing it either, where it's less to make a difference. Our game, you give a guy a pitch, could mean 6 runs. You don't give anybody anything. If you make a mistake, you live and die with it. That's the nature of the profession. I'm not going to blame St. Louis for a play I missed on Pittsburgh's, so I'm going to take one away from St. Louis. I get the biggest kick out of that, Dave, and I hear that a lot, but all that tells me is how much ignorance there is in this game.
Sammy Sosa was recently caught corking his bat. It's enough for umpires to try and keep track of what happens on the field, but some players will look for an edge in equipment. They may try and grease the ball. How do you keep track of that? Do you think players do they cheat out there?
I'm sure there's a lot of cheating going on, but that's not my job to be a policeman. My job is to call the game. Now, if I see something, or like in the Sosa situation where it broken, the stuff's all over the field, I mean, that's an obvious situation. It's a different animal. But to go out there and sneak behind a guy and wipe his butt to see if he's got grease on it, I'll pass. I know who cheats, who doesn't cheat, but you don't know how much they cheat. I mean, I used to know that Gaylord Perry cheated.
Well, what do you mean? What do you mean by that? How do you know?
Well, he used to
cheats?
Throw a thing called a puff ball. He would take the rosin bag and put it on his palm. Then he'd throw a pitch, and when he released the ball, all the smoke would come out. You couldn't see the pitch. So I used to tell him, I said, I'll tell you what, Gaylord, I'm not going to throw you out for this, but I'll tell you what, every time you do that, I'm going to call it a ball. Every time. I don't care. If bases are loaded, the win and run, and you throw it right down the middle, I'm calling it a ball. He tried me 3 times, and 3 times I called a ball. He walked into me, he says, I'll never do it again. I said, you got it.
Your knee was injured in a game. What happened there?
Well, I've been hurt several times in my career. I mean, I had a neck injury. It was worse than my knee injury. I caught a foul tip that hit me in the side of the mask and the neck. And between C6 and 7, it's never been right yet. I had a pinched nerve put me out for like over 3.5 months, and I still have it to this day. Matter of fact, I've been getting treatment on it lately, and it's caused by baseball, and I can't even get medical insurance for it. I hurt my knees several times. I got hit with foul tips. I've had catchers turn the wrong way and hit me and knock a knee out. I mean, if you look at the game today, I guess they got about, today, I think there's 8 players out now that are regular umpires for injury. So we're just like players. We get hurt, too.
Let me come back to that. You're bending over a catcher, concentrating on getting a call right from a ball that can be coming at you at 90 miles an hour. Batter swings, goes off his bat. Catcher can't get it. It hits you in the neck, the shoulder maybe. How do you then ignore the pain, get back in there, and try and concentrate on the next pitch?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Dave, because people don't realize the pain and stuff that goes with it. It's just you got to do it. I mean, if you don't, you know, the old theory is if I go down, then somebody else has to come in and finish my game. Well, you know, you have that macho ego type thing. Well, darn it, I'm hurt, but I'm going to finish that game. I've seen guys work. I saw one kid work in the minor leagues. A guy broke the bat off, and it stuck in his shoulder. Went right through the chest protector. In those days, they had real terrible chest protectors, those thin ones, those National League protectors.
Impaled
it? Stuck right in his shoulder like an arrow. And they pulled it out, and he finished the game.
Now,
which I thought he was totally nuts.
Now, after you catch one of these foul tips and you manage to finish the game, you go home and your shoulder swells up, you ice it. I mean, don't you wonder, gosh, do I ever want to get back in front of the plate again? When you get back next time it's your time to call the balls and strikes at the plate, do you think, I don't really want to be here?
Well, you also think of your daughter going to college, you got to pay that next tuition payment. So, so it makes that pain ease a little bit better. you don't really say you don't want to do this, but you know you. It seems like when you get hit once, you're going to hit again, or you might go 25 games and nothing will happen. It's just it's like a time machine. Sooner or later, this thing's going to go off. And it's going to get you.
Well, Ken Kaiser, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Hey, Dave, thanks for having me, buddy. I appreciate it.
Former Major League umpire Ken Kaiser. His story of a life calling games and throwing out managers is Planet of the Umps. Coming up, we meet filmmaker Helen Stickler, whose new documentary tells the story of a star skateboarder whose journey took him to fame, wealth, emotional decline, and eventually murder. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Skateboarding is an everyday passion for many American teens. Though some adults regard street skaters as public nuisances, the nation's top skaters tour professionally, making good livings and achieving celebrity among a devoted following. A powerful documentary film opening in New York this week chronicles the rise of commercial skateboarding in the 1980s through the tragic story of its most marketable star. Mark Rogowski, known in the skating world as Gator, combined athletic talent and showmanship to become a giant of skateboarding, but fell apart emotionally when the industry changed. His psychological decline ended in homicidal rage when Rogowski sadistically raped and murdered a woman in his apartment. He's currently serving a prison term for the murder of Jessica Bergston. The documentary about Rogowski is called Stoked, The Rise and Fall of Gator. Early in the film, we hear this segment of a telephone prison call from Rogowski.
It's been hard over these 10 years to understand how I could have become so weak or, you know, so affected that I ended up hurting Jessica Bergston. I was a coward, emotionally and mentally. I hate what I did, and I've hated myself, my life, and my past. Even any good I did before seems to pale in comparison. Like wiped out by my crime.
My guests are Helen Stickler, who produced and directed Stoked, and Ken Park, a former professional skater and a friend of Mark Rogowski's, who's interviewed in the film. Park eventually left skateboarding for college and a business career and is now president of a New York-based technology firm. Helen Stickler is an Emmy-nominated writer, producer, and director of documentary films and commercials. Her best-known documentary short is Andre the Giant Has a Posse. I asked Stickler how Mark Rogowski became a star.
He was a star of a skate video called Skate Visions, which was produced by Vision Skateboards. Through his sponsorship with Vision, he did receive he received royalties on skateboard decks, which had his graphic on it, and later through a clothing line, which also had his graphic, which was a kind of a descending spiral. It was an op art design, which they used for a number of years, and it was a top graphic in the 80s. And the graphic and the image that was created for him at Vision really served to brand him. He, I think you could say, was one of the first skateboarders to really, really understand and utilize the concept of branding. And a lot of that was because of Brad Dorfman, who ran Vision Streetwear.
When you saw someone like Mark, who, and I've said this so many times, way before the fame and way before the sponsorship even, you would be at the skate park with 7-8 other people in this, you know, tremendously large skateboard park, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Mark would appear. He'd never make a grand entrance, but he'd start consistently or systematically going from one of the areas to the next in the skate park. And I'm talking about areas in the skate park that nobody rode because they were either just incredibly non-rideable as the skateboard terrain goes, or it just everyone focused on this one area near the front of the park that had the keyhole, what we called the keyhole, which is one of the pools. But, you know, here's a guy that would go out, and literally every time he showed up to the park, he would skate every inch of that skate park. And he would do it with such style and such flair and such confidence that whether you liked the person wasn't really that important because you couldn't help but respect the guy. He was just so gifted for this sport.
One of the things that established the image of Mark Rogowski, Helen Stickler, you note in your documentary, was the events at Virginia Beach in 1986. Mm-hmm. What did Mark do there that had such impact?
The Mount Trashmore event was a skateboard contest that happened every year in Virginia Beach in 1986. Mark went out there and he got into a little bit of trouble with the law. The contest was really, really big. The local authorities had doubled up the number of police and security guards just as a way to have crowd control. And what I was told is that Mark went out to either his hotel or went out to get some fast food. He just took off in his car to run an errand during the body of the contest. And when he came back, he pulled into the wrong parking lot or the wrong parking spot, or he didn't want to stop and get checked. So the what he thought was a security guard had followed him over to the car and jumped up and was, you know, ran up to the car window to get him. And he thought he was a security guard, and he punched him. And it was an actual state trooper or local, you know, policeman. So they arrested him, took him down to jail right in the middle of the contest. And three of the top industry people at the time went down there and bailed him out. I think Brad Dorfman told me it was something like $400. And they took him back to the contest, and he skated that day. It was an event for those, you know, thousands and thousands of kids that were there, and they didn't really like the high police security presence that was there either. There was a lot of tension going on, and he just manifested it. And either by coincidence or design, the next month's magazines, he got more coverage between ads, editorial, and photo opportunities than he did at any other time in his career. I think in his mind, being on top of the world and then getting away with something like that, it just solidified you know, his kind of bad boy image for himself as well as everyone else.
My guests are Helen Stickler, who produced and directed the film Stoked, The Rise and Fall of Gator, and former professional skateboarder Ken Parks. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com, from the National Endowment for the Arts, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Place of Hiding, a novel of mystery set on the island of Guernsey by Elizabeth George, author of the Inspector Lindley Mysteries. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz highlights the work of the late American composer Jerome Maross. His score for The Big Country was nominated for an Oscar. And we continue our conversation with filmmaker Helen Stickler and former skateboarder Kenneth Park.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's continue our interview with documentary filmmaker Helen Stickler and former professional skateboarder Kenneth Park. Stickler's new documentary film, Stoked, chronicles the career of star skateboarder Mark Gator Rogowski. He rode his board to wealth and fame in the 1980s, but is now serving a prison term for rape and murder. When we left off, we were talking about the bad boy image Rogowski was cultivating at the height of his celebrity. Here's a clip from the film.
Well, I think I need to be interviewed, not only because I'm one of the most elite and dynamic, talented, big-headed, and versatile skaters on the circuit, but also because I'm one of the most blatant and outspoken jerks in the industry. It's really easy to say what you want, what's on your mind, and get away with it when you work for a company like Vision. It's really easy. There's no problems. You can always have a bad write-up in the local gossip column of Thrasher or Transworld, and receive some kind of promotion or exposure from it. It's great. I love getting arrested. I think I'm one of the most illegal skaters in the circuit too.
Looking back on it, I mean, is this the beginning of the kind of undoing of Mark Rogowski? Is this the criminal that we later see, or is this just a guy who enjoys a rebel image?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't want to take that out of context, because that piece of video was an outtake and he was joking around. I mean, he was definitely kind of teasing with his interviewer at that moment. He was being asked some kind of like mundane skateboard video questions, you know, like, why do you think you should be interviewed, was the question. Not such a great question, you know. And so he came up with an answer that was a joke, but there's a lot of the grain of a part of his personality is in there.
There was a change in skateboarding in the late 80s, which really hurt Mark Rogowski's image and his commercial potential. What was that all about?
Well, towards the end of the 80s, the vertical backyard ramp scene and the skate park scene, which was also mostly a vertical skating scene, was starting to die out for a number of reasons. A lot of the skate parks closed, and a lot of the backyard ramps were falling apart, and they're kind of expensive to maintain. And there was also the issue of liability at that time. If you were definitely liable if a kid was on your ramp while you weren't there and got hurt. So parents weren't supporting them as much anymore. So also because skateboarding had become so popular worldwide, you had kids who were in urban areas or over in Europe or wherever, where they weren't going to necessarily have access to backyard ramps, who wanted to skate. So they started to skate on other terrain. They started to skate on the streets, and they started to use park benches and handrails and all kinds of ledges and things that you could find in urban centers as obstacles to skate on. And Mark, definitely came from a suburban background. He was still very focused on vert skating. And he was also, at that time when this started happening in the late 80s, he was really focused on his career at that time. And so this transition was happening. And Mark was getting a little older. He was getting more into the business end of things. And the younger kids coming up were doing a different style of skating. A change happened that he wasn't exactly a part of.
So this street skating phenomena arose, and he didn't have the moves and the skills for it, right? I mean, some of the most compelling video you have is him attempting to learn some street skating moves and flinging his skateboard to the pavement in frustration. It's pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, that particular clip is another outtake from a skateboard video that was shot in the very late 80s, and a couple things are going on. Like, Mark is trying to do vert moves on the curb, and I think he was trying to innovate, but what I see in that shot is that he's under pressure because camera's pointed at him, and they're like, okay, Mark, be a star, do some street skating. We need street skating because that's what we're promoting now, and it wasn't his thing. So when he's reacting in anger, it's a combination of things going on in his head. Like, he doesn't really have the moves because it isn't his thing. He's under all kinds of pressure. He's failing to himself and in front of the camera, which means the eyes of all of his public. So you can really see his frustration coming out, like all this anger, and he yells, "I suck." That's he's just upset with himself. You know, later on, he did, yeah, he did master the handrail, and, you know, he did get to do some more street skating, but it was a little too late for him at that point. And I also kind of feel like maybe he wasn't as hungry for it anymore. Like, he'd had his moment in the sun, he was ready to move on to other things, but he still wasn't quite ready to let it go. And I think there's a lot of conflict there, you know, for him, because he could have gotten good at it if he wanted to practice it as, you know, as hard as you need to practice to get good. I don't know if he had that drive in him anymore. And
if I can add one aspect of street skating, you have to understand, when you watch someone skate a pool or you watch someone skate a vert ramp, it's the series of tricks that makes that so exciting and so enthralling to be a part of. You're literally doing 8 to 16 tricks, one after another, gaining more and more speed every single step along that ride. So because the kids that had now grown so attached to the sport might not have been able to even perform on a vertical ramp on one of the backyard ramps, what they end up doing is going down to the schoolyard. And street skating evolved as more of a one-trick type of progression. You would try one thing over and over and over again. So for someone that had grown up in pools and someone that had grown up on the backyard ramps, where it was the continuity of your run that gave you the thrill, trying one trick and missing it 30 times in a row so that you could make it on the 31st attempt was the furthest thing from enjoyable. And so here's this massively popular uprising in skateboarding taking place. And I think that the typical skater that had been in the pro circuit and had been skating the vertical ramps and that had been skating the pools just really had a hard time embracing an activity that was so dramatically different from what they had grown up doing.
We're speaking with Helen Stickler. She is a documentary producer, and her newest film is Stoked, The Rise and Fall of Gator, about the career of professional skater Mark Rogowski. Also with us, former professional skater Ken Park. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Our guests are documentary filmmaker Helen Stickler and former professional skateboarder Kenneth Park. Stickler's new documentary film is Stoked, about star skateboarder Mark Rogowski. Rogowski's career declined in the late 1980s as trends in skateboarding changed. His friends worried about his mental health. He'd been a heavy drinker, and they were surprised when he became a born-again Christian. Ken Park, what did you observe of Mark during this period when his fortunes were falling?
Well, I think that the first thing I noticed is that before his financial fortunes had fallen, the notoriety and attention and respect had fallen first. And I think he had a much harder time to a certain extent with that aspect of what he was losing than even making the adaptation to the loss of finances, because he had been, you know, in a situation in his life where he didn't have much money. And yes, now he had gone from having a lot to maybe not having as much. But the loss of attention, the loss of respect, the loss of notoriety, it changed his personality dramatically. In fact, one specific occurrence, I approached him at a party at his house in Fallbrook, which is shown in the movie. And I pulled him aside and I looked him in the eye as a friend to a friend, not as a skater to a skater. And I said, Mark, I think you're losing sight of who it is that you are. And I think you're losing sight of how, in the scope of things, the skateboarding part of our lives is just one small aspect, and it's going to be fleeting and it's going to be transitional. And you're pushing people away from you. And if it doesn't stop, you're going to lose us. And he looked me right back in the eye and said, then I'll lose you. And literally, that was the finality of our really close relationship, all summed up with one statement. And I remember being pained by that moment, because we had grown like two brothers, very fond and very supportive of each other, even though we were very different people.
This is the period in which he ends up committing the crime that got him in prison. How did he end up coming into contact with Jessica Bergston?
The victim of his crime had been his girlfriend's best friend when they were younger, and Mark had only met Jessica a few times in his life, and she was not even living in California. What happened is Mark and Brandy split up, and because they'd had such an off-and-on relationship throughout their whole time together, in the past, when he'd pushed her away, she would always be brokenhearted and crying, and he was always able to get her back pretty easily. And what happened this final time, because he had just become, I think she'd come to the end of her attraction with him. I mean, I think that they were still attracted, but what happened the final time that he pushed her away is that she found someone else. And this just didn't bode well. Mark started to follow her. He broke into her mother's house where she was living, and he took back everything he'd ever given her. She told me that later he took back a car that he'd bought her, just like a used Volkswagen car that he'd gotten her. Later she told me that the cops found the car with all of her stuff in it burnt to a shell in the desert. She was really frightened, and he would call and leave threatening messages on her answering machine, quoting from the Bible and using the Bible as a way to justify his anger towards her and prove that she was a sinner and that, you know, she needed to change her ways and on and on and on. And so, you know, she was ready to get out of the relationship. And coincidentally, at the time, she had gotten an opportunity to move to New York, which is something she'd always wanted to do. Mark was really pressuring her to become a born-again Christian and settle down and lead a quiet life. He was ready to put, you know, skating behind him, I think, because, as Ken mentioned earlier, skating had already made that decision for him. Brandy was 20 years old, and she just wanted to explore life and have adventures. She was definitely not on the same track. So Brandy moved to New York, and then her friend moved to San Diego right around the same time, and her friend gave Gator a call. And it was just the wrong place at the wrong time.
What happened?
Well, Mark had a lot of unresolved anger in his life, and it goes way deep. You know, it wasn't just skating. It wasn't just his girlfriend leaving him. It was, you know, his family situation. I think there was just abandonment issues that he had that were unresolved. He had a drinking problem that just made the whole thing worse. And he was an undiagnosed bipolar manic depressive. So he had been going into a deep spiral of depression and not dealing with it at all. And this young lady came along, and he just took out all of his rage and anger upon her. I don't think it was... You know, I think it was just a shock to everybody, including himself.
So he meets her for lunch, that's right. And is that right? And then brings her back to his apartment?
Yeah. She had called him, and he'd called her back, and they'd gone back and forth talking on the phone for a while. She'd literally only been in town for a number of days. And they made a date to meet for lunch. He had some meetings in the morning with his manager. Actually, he called her from Bill Silva's office to you know, confirm the date. Went and picked her up in Pacific Beach, where she lived, which is a kind of a really youth-centered, kind of hip, you know, sort of place in San Diego. Picked her up, took her to La Jolla. They had lunch. And then it just became an extended day. They decided to go back to his place. They picked up some wine along the way, some videos. He had not been drinking for a while because he'd been trying to clean up his act and lead a Christian life. And I think during the course of that day, you know, there was a lot of back and forth about his decisions to you know, become a Christian and to walk the path with Jesus. And that became a source of you know, conversation and debate between the two of them. The day stretched on very long. Sometime that night, you know, he beat her and raped her, and in the morning put her into a surfboard bag and zipped it up, and she died.
So her body was found, right?
Yeah, her body, her remains were found by some campers out in the desert. They were found several weeks after she was left there, and it was identified as her body was identified as a Jane Doe. At the time that this was going on, there were something like 30 women in the Southern California area that were missing that fit her description. So there weren't a lot of leads to go on. Mark was questioned because the phone records showed that they had had conversations, and he denied having ever seen her. And some months later, he confessed. He went to his religious mentor, and he told him what he had done. They discussed it. They, in the early morning hours, went down to San Diego to the police station and said, you know, he said, I've committed murder, and I want to confess. And they said, you know, where did it happen? Where do you live? He said, Oceanside. They say, you need to go up to the Vista County Police. So he had to go to another police station. And, you know, I mean, they just said, go up there and you're at the wrong station. So he went uptown and he confessed there. And they were like, okay. They didn't even have anything on. I mean, they had the missing person on file, but they didn't have this listed as a possible homicide. So they just basically advised him of his rights, which he waived, and he gave a full confession, you know, a very lucid full confession. And then he led them to where he had left the body, and they called the local authorities there, who confirmed that they had found a Jane Doe in that area some weeks earlier.
You know, the last 10 minutes of your film is not easy to watch as you go through the details of this crime. And as a storyteller, I mean, I wonder if you felt that you had to keep that from the audience for most of the film in order to make it. I wonder if you had to keep that from the audience to prevent the film from just being too dark. I mean, it is such a savage crime.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, we spent a lot of time. That was the toughest thing. And documentaries are put together in the editing room. You know the story going in, but you don't have a script. You don't have a blueprint when you start to put it together. So we did experiment with a lot of different structures for the narrative. And I even had some kind of work-in-progress shows for, you know, colleges and for lots of groups of people trying to figure out what was the best way to present the story. There was so much going on in the story. It covers 10 years. It's only 80 minutes long. It's got working on all these different levels. It's about an individual story. It's about skateboarding culture. It's about pop culture. And it has to combine this really, all the innocence, all the commercialism of the years, and then this horrible crime, and balance all that out, and then also somehow have some semblance of a resolution at the end. So we do tip people off at the beginning that a crime has been committed, but it's not until later and that you find out all the details. And I felt like I didn't want to hold back on what he had done, just as I didn't hold back on how great he was in the beginning. You know, I let everything be in there, all extremes, because that was the truth of the matter.
Documentary filmmaker Helen Stickler and former professional skateboarder Kenneth Park. Stickler's film, Stoked, about 1980s skating star Mark Rogowski, opens in New York this week. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz on the music of American composer Jerome Maross. This is Fresh Air. The music of some composers is often more familiar than the name of the person who wrote it. People who recognize the music from the Western The Big Country or the cabaret standard Lazy Afternoon might not know they were both composed by Jerome Maross, who died in 1983 and was born 100 years ago this month. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has this tribute.
Jerome Maross was a prodigy, a disciple of Aaron Copland, Charles Ives, and Henry Cowell.
a high school friend of the legendary film composer Bernard Herrmann, and an assistant to George Gershwin. He was part of a movement of composers who were breaking away from European traditions and bringing American idioms, folk music, ragtime, blues, foxtrots, and one-steps to theater, ballet, opera, the concert hall, and film. He was nominated for an Academy Award for what many people consider the best music ever composed for a movie western, William Wyler's The Big Country, starring Gregory Peck and Burl Ives, who won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar. The first time I saw Jerome Maras's name was on my original cast album of The Golden Apple, an experimental off-Broadway musical that won the New York Drama Critics Award as Best Musical of the 1953-54 season and the first show to go from off-Broadway to Broadway. It was a daring enterprise, really an opera, but disguised as a musical comedy with no spoken dialogue. It had a huge influence, especially on Leonard Bernstein. The Golden Apple moved Greek myth from Mount Olympus in Greece to Mount Olympus in Washington State just after the Spanish-American War. Kay Ballard played an American Helen of Troy and introduced a song that has become a standard for nightclub and cabaret singers, the seductive Lazy Afternoon. Here she is on the cast album.
Zooming and the tulip trees are blooming, and there's not another human in view but us two. It's a lazy afternoon, and the farmer leaves his reaping, and the meadow cows are sleeping, and the speckled trout stop leaping upstream as we as it grows. It's a lazy afternoon.
The lyrics to Lazy Afternoon are by John Latouche, who collaborated with Maras on another ingenious work, four short dance operas called Ballet Ballads. Maras also uses American mythology brilliantly in his 1945 ballet score, Frankie and Johnny, which transforms the theme of that raunchy old song in highly dramatic and surprising ways. This excerpt is with the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Joanne Folletta. Moss's first work in Hollywood was orchestrating scores by other composers. For example, Aaron Copland's theme music for the movie version of Our Town. Later, he got to do his own original scores. Besides The Big Country, some of his better-known films are The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Five Finger Exercise, Rachel Rachel, Paul Newman's first directorial stint, and Otto Preminger's The Cardinal. His most famous composition was probably the theme music for the popular 50s TV western Wagon Train. But Moross was also a classical musician of distinction. The premiere of his first symphony was conducted by no less a musical eminence than Sir Thomas Beecham. Jerome Moross refused to get stuck in a single groove. He wrote music that both the most and least sophisticated listeners could enjoy. He deserves and rewards serious attention. He shouldn't be forgotten.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix. Jerome Moross composed the music for The Big Country, which is now out on DVD. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Roberta Shorrock, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, Ian Chillog, and Megan Howell. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. And from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bass player Ron Carter has a new CD. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about his life and music, including his classic recordings with Miles Davis. Join us for the next Fresh Air.